Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news. The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
As we all know, we're nearing that one-year mark since the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And as Ukrainians continue to fight to defend their country, the continued war requires tapping into a vast donor network that's blossomed over the past 12 months to supply soldiers with everything from boots to battle tanks, Carol.
Yeah, we're talking crowdfunding. Who knew? Well, our Mark Champion knew. This story, by the way, is today's Bloomberg Big Take. It is one of our most read stories on the Bloomberg. As we said, it is also today's Big Take podcast, which you can find at Bloomberg.com. or wherever you get your podcasts, and be sure to not miss the Big Take on Bloomberg Radio. That's weeknights at 11 p.m. Wall Street time. Mark Champion, Bloomberg News senior reporter for international affairs, who wrote the story. He is in London. Mark, incredible story. Like I said, who knew it? It's kind of a form of crowdfunding. Tell us what exactly is going on.
Yes, well, I've been going, you know, in and out of Ukraine for the last year, and it really struck me every time I went. The amount of just stuff that was getting, provided to the front, wherever you were. You went into a company, they had a warehouse full of stuff, and it was all donated. And the more I, was there, the more it became clear that this isn't just, you know, the normal stuff you'd expect about, you know, food for refugees and so on, but it was also weapons for the front, cars for the front, everything that you can imagine that, you know, people just, they all have relatives there. Their sons and brothers and fathers are all at the front, and they were trying to find the stuff that they said they needed. And so they're filling all the gaps. But the scale has become really enormous. So, you know, the one fund that in particular that I talked to called Come Back Alive, they raised $160 million in the last year. There's others of similar scale. The Central Bank, if you want to just give extra money to the Defense Ministry, the Central Bank has raised $650 million. Beyond those funds, which they are funding sort of expensive million-dollar drones and mortars and all sorts of things like that, but beyond those funds, you just have the tiniest little operations all over the place. You know, one place I went to was a guy who's a former graffiti artist who decided he was just going to help all his friends who were going to the front, and they were taking their cars, and he camouflaged them. So he camouflaged, you know, around 1,800 vehicles, and then also rifles and all sorts of things.
That's such an interesting point. I wonder if that means that there's a sense on the ground that the folks who are responsible for the crowdfunding understand the needs of civilians in the area in a way that maybe the big players like the U.S. funders don't necessarily understand. Was that your impression, Mark?
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, there's just a lot of, you know, gaps to fill. And, you know, yeah. The U.S. can't be on top of all of that. The Ukrainian Defense Ministry, you know, for reasons of money or bureaucracy or whatever, it can't do everything. This is something that Ukraine has become very used to. Because they had very sort of inefficient and corrupt governments, they became, over more than a decade, they built up this sort of instinct to crowdfund, no matter what it is. You know, a popular uprising like the Maidan protests in 2014, or then when the war began in the Donbass in 2014-15, immediately the first instinct is not to ask the government, you know, because you don't think you'll get anything from the government. If you give anything to the government, you think it'll disappear. Mm. So people have just become used to doing stuff themselves. They just instantly do it, and they just instantly begin Facebook groups and so on to say, let's get a car for so-and-so so that he can go to the front. So it's just really ingrained, and I think it is actually more important than the dollar value, simply because it says to every soldier at the front, you know, I've got an entire society behind me.
Talk to us about some of the people behind some of these crowdfunding efforts. We're talking about, what, Hollywood celebrities? We're talking about oligarchs? We're talking about everybody?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, the fund that was set up by the president, President Zelensky, he has one called United 24, and they've raised $287 million. And for that fund, he has really reached out, and he's persuaded Barbara Streisand to be an ambassador of the fund. There's a number of other celebrities that have become attached to the fund in one way or another. And so they raise money. And then you have others who are, as you mentioned, the oligarchs. You know, some of the oligarchs who were not very popular and were even seen, you know, some years ago as being kind of pro-Russian because they supported the party that former President Yanukovych used to, you know, represent. So, you know, Arinat Akhmetov, who's the richest man in Ukraine. He has a big steel company called Metinvest. They owned Azovstal in Mariupol, the steel plant where there was the last stand was made in Mariupol. They've lost a lot of their assets, but he has actually provided 150,000 sets of bulletproof vests, which they've made in his factories, you know, 80,000 tank traps, all kinds of stuff, which really does mount up.
Well, Carol, you bring up a great question about the people who fund this effort and who have kind of been the leaders behind it. I wonder, Mark, if you can talk about the people who are most impacted by it. Is this civilians? Is it folks who are actually fighting? Who is most benefiting from this extra cash?
Well, it really is everybody, but the Ukrainians are focused very much, you know, on people who remain in areas that are either at the front, or they're in areas that were occupied and were then retaken by the Ukrainians. And services there have sort of broken down. Medical services, you know, food is difficult to sort of distribute, all those sorts of things. So, you know, as I say, the great strength of this is that it's incredibly flexible. It just kind of responds because everybody knows somebody. And they then move into these areas and provide services that the government is just, you know, incapable or too slow or, you know, doesn't have the resources to do. And it really is a kind of lifesaver in these areas. It is for civilians, but a lot of it is for the front, for the soldiers.
What's interesting, too, and it's funny, you know, Mark, as we were getting ready and talking about your story in the newsroom, one of the things that came up from one of our producers, Ariagami, he said, you know, wait a minute, I don't understand. The U.S. is sending billions of dollars in equipment and providing support. We know other nations and allies of the U.S. are certainly, and of Ukraine, are providing support. Why is this ultimately necessary?
Because nothing is enough. I mean, this is a big war. We haven't seen a war like this since World War II in terms of pure intensity. I mean, there have been other very intense wars, but not like this. And, you know, the Russian side in particular is very well armed. It has the entire, you know, not the entire stocks, but the predominant part of the stocks of the former Soviet Union that it built up for the Cold War. And in many ways, this is, you know, they're running down through the Cold War stocks of the former Soviet Union. The Ukrainians on the other side, you know, they started this war with around 1,600 tanks. You know, Germany has 300. You know, Britain has 226. So it's, you know, it's not like they had nothing, but you need so much in order to pursue a war like this. It just eats resources at an incredible rate. And you need a lot of everything because it gets destroyed. You know, 90% of drones get destroyed. Pickup trucks that people bring, they get destroyed either, you know, because they get hit or they just, you know, in accidents or they just, you know, get stuck in mud or whatever. It just eats through resources at an incredible rate.
And to be fair, we've talked about the new double issue of Bloomberg Business Week that's out. Cover story is, of course, marking the 1 year Russian invasion into Ukraine, but talks about, you know, specifically, Maddie, the shortage of ammunition on both sides. I mean, yeah. Both sides are going through a lot when it comes to any kind of defense equipment, and they're just kind of running through it.
Yeah, and it's so critical. I wonder, Mark, in our final kind of 30 seconds with you here, if you can talk about, you mentioned the intensity of the war. What is something that you understand about the situation on the ground that folks who haven't been in Ukraine might be missing about the story?
Well, I think when you hear that the war has slowed down in the east, and yet you hit, then the casualty rates are really high. That is simply about intensity. So they may not be moving, but there is a lot of artillery shells that are just being exchanged on either side, and bodies now at this part of the war, just bodies on the Russian side being thrown at the war. So when you hear that nothing's moved or slowed, it doesn't mean that the war has slowed down in terms of intensity, and it hasn't at all.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing, though, and to think about it, was just a year ago that it all started, but you look at how much devastation and how many resources are still needed to continue on. Mark Champion, incredible story. Mark is Senior Reporter for International Affairs at Bloomberg News, joining us on the phone from London. Be sure to check out his Bloomberg Big Take. You can also find it on the Bloomberg Terminal. Of course, check out the Bloomberg Big Take on Bloomberg Radio weeknights at 11 p.m.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's Stifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Street time.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekdays from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live to our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Chinese President Xi urging his country to accelerate fundamental scientific research so it can become self-reliant in critical technologies, basically really kind of countering Washington sanctions on everything from semis to software. You've also got a Chinese top diplomat calling for peace talks to resolve the Russian war in Ukraine. And then there is a fascinating Bloomberg opinion piece today that talks about if American intelligence is right and China really is about to arm Russia in its genocidal war against Ukraine, we may be entering a new era in international relations, asking if it may be an even more dangerous one. To address it all, we've got Ed Price, principal for the geopolitical forecasting firm, of geopolitical forecasting at Ergo, which is a global intelligence consulting and forecasting firm. By the way, Ed, a former British trade official, he's worked with members of the European and British parliaments. We are so delighted to have him here with Maddie and myself. Ed, there is so much going on. How do you separate out the wheat from the chaff when it comes to what's going on in foreign affairs and geopolitics?
Hi, Carol. Hi, Matthew. I hope you guys are very well. It's difficult, right? It's really hard right now to separate the signal from the noise. My firm was previously very successful at doing that at the start of this war. If you remember, we very successfully called it. You know, we said they were going in with a 70 to 80% confidence a year ago today. A year later, it does seem that the war in Ukraine is harder to read, I would suggest, although there are probably a few themes that we can point to that might help. One of them, Carol, is that just at the moment that it seems that Russian mistakes are compounding, and by Russian mistakes, I mean the sort of strategic tomfoolery of using your best troops, your Spetsnaz, your naval infantry, your paratroopers at the start of the conflict and getting them essentially killed disproportionate to other troops. Strategic mistakes like that are compounding at just the time that the Ukrainians are getting new vehicles, new equipment, and their morale is very high. So I think that's maybe one theme.
So when we zoom out from the Russia-Ukraine situation and look a little bit more broadly at all of the global geopolitical tensions right now, Ukraine, China, the global economy, spy balloons, what is your biggest concern and situation to watch for the year ahead?
Right. I mean, I would be very clear that my biggest concern is not necessarily the most likely concern. The biggest concern, of course, should be that this local war in Ukraine and that the threat of conflict over or in Taiwan become the same thing, and that there is a general confluence of the sorts of trends that we're seeing with regard to great power competition. Right now, I don't think that that's likely. That must remain the biggest concern. But within that, I mean, you guys just mentioned the fact that the Chinese might be thinking about arming the Russians, or at least helping with materiel. That is a concern because, of course, you know, ridiculous spy balloons are one thing, but sending arms, sending lethal aid to Europe from China, you know, when you think about it, that's very concerning.
You know, it's interesting in this opinion piece, too. It says Chinese military support for Russia. Again, it's an opinion piece by Andreas Kluth, said Chinese military support for Russia would finally turn the Ukrainian conflict into a proxy war between two hostile blocs, with a third trying to stay out of the fray. And it does. I do wonder, you know, Ed, do we need to be thinking that this is where we're going? We've talked about kind of a technology war and different things going on, but is this what happened? We're dividing the world up into maybe three key blocks here.
Yeah. I think the essence of the problem is that Uncle Sam did half a job after the Second World War. And by that, I mean he conquered three countries, Germany, Japan, and the United Kingdom. I wouldn't necessarily put it like that to my friends, but he did. And filled those three countries with two things, democracy and free markets. For then some unknown reason after that, Uncle Sam decided that the two big naughty countries, China and Russia, and again, I wouldn't necessarily call them naughty to their faces, but the two big naughty countries were only given access to markets. Right. And not there wasn't a concerted effort to export democracy to Russia and China. So in a way, we Americans, I'm American now, we Americans have done half a job after the Second World War. And the big question is, can you get away with that? Is it OK that democracy only really went halfway around the world when the means of markets and capitalism went all the way around?
That's so interesting. I love the way you put that. My question with China and the U.S. specifically is always like, it's a symbiotic relationship, right? If we need each other, can China really afford to risk interacting with Russia on the war when its economy just reopened? I wonder, in the context of what you just mentioned about China embracing free markets but not democracy, how you think about that relationship.
Well, I don't want to get too deep and dark here, but if you think about the Chinese ability as an autocracy, as a totalitarian regime, to absorb the sort of punishment that a future sanctions or blockade regime might impose on it, it doesn't care about human life in the same way that Americans do, right? And that Europeans do. That's not to say that your average Chinese individual or Chinese household doesn't care about life. I'm talking about the government, to be clear. And so PRC, I think, will be able to pull things out of the bag in a future confrontation that look more like and feel more like an autarky, a strategic autarky, for which I suspect Belt and Road has been a pretty good preparation in many ways, that probably surprise us. And so really the question is, to what extent can European economies and The American economy withstand a direct economic confrontation. I mean, I've said it before, maybe we need some sort of strategic garden furniture reserve. You know, it's a silly way of putting it, but we're on the hook.
No, that is a really, really good point. And it's interesting, you know, we had a great story out from our Bloomberg team about what the UK government basically was doing and kind of doing a disaster scenario if China invaded Taiwan and TSMC was shut down or impacted the global supply chain, as we know that they produce so many, 90% of the chips used in the world. So I guess I always think about what's the constructive conversation as all this stuff is going on, where investment strategists, Ed, continue to say that the big concerns this year are geopolitical. You know, we're seeing that. So what is the constructive? And we've only got about 45 seconds left here.
The constructive answer on Taiwan is don't worry about it right now. Ergo's best sources have the prospect of an invasion at a very, very low chance. That's for all sorts of reasons that we can get into another day. But do expect some kind of disruption, something stopping short of a blockade, because, of course, that's an act of war. But do expect that the PRC and the Communist Party in China are going to make life more difficult in that region.
20 seconds left. Still worried about Russia?
I'm always worried about Russia. Yes, of course I'm always worried about Russia, but I think we're on top and I think Ukrainians will win.
All right. Listen, great to check in with you. I know it's busy on your end as well, so thanks for carving out some time. Ed Price, his principal at Ergo, former British trade official, of course, joining us via Zoom here, I believe is in New York City. All right. You are listening and watching Bloomberg Business Week. Carol Masser along with Madison Mills. A lot to think about, but I do feel like this is a year that, once again, geopolitical is front and center.
And really interesting to hear him saying the positive thing at the end there. He thinks Ukraine's going to win.
Yeah, fascinating, right? All right, folks, we'll continue to cover an update on the markets coming your way in just a moment. This is Bloomberg Radio.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus global business, finance, and tech news. The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Masser and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
So we're talking about the last jobs report where we had about more than 500,000 jobs in January created. I mean, it was just massive. You also had the unemployment rate unexpectedly retreating to its lowest since 1969. We know, Maddie, that the tight labor market persists for many types of workers, including blacksmiths. Enter robots.
Such a cool story we've got here. With more on this story, you can find it online at Bloomberg.com/businessweek and on the Bloomberg. But let's get to it with Ashley Vance, Bloomberg Businessweek features writer and author of Elon Musk, Tesla, SpaceX, and the Quest for Fantastic Future. Ashley joins us via Zoom from Palo Alto, California. Ashley, great to speak with you. I think we are all incredibly jealous of you because you have the coolest job in the world. You get to try all of this cool stuff. Tell me about this latest cool technology that you tried out.
Yeah, well, a few months ago, I went to this company called Machina Labs. They're based in Southern California near Los Angeles. And they've developed these robots, but really some software and a lot of sensors to go along with it that allows them to bend sheet metal, to shape metal in ways that would have been done, well, that has been done for centuries by blacksmiths. And you know, it's just this kind of radical new form of manufacturing, automated manufacturing, that could be a huge boon to industry overall.
Is this ultimately actually something that can really scale up, ramp up at some point in the future?
Yeah, you know, right now this company, Machina, they're working with NASA, the Air Force. They're building, in some cases, kind of spare parts for a fighter jet that's really hard to source, or body panels for a rocket or something like that. So not quite mass manufacturing yet. The plan, you know, is if all things work out, is to have tons of these robots and have them going at this on a larger scale. And so it could be, but, you know, in general, mass manufacturing with dies where you're stamping out parts will probably be cheaper for a long time. But this still has a big role to play.
All right. Ashley, I'm waiting for everybody on Twitter to be like, see, we were right. Robots are going to replace our jobs. I mean, but that's not kind of what this is about. This is, I mean, we don't have a lot of folks necessarily going into wanting to be blacksmiths or metalworking, right? And we have a tight labor market, but there's even a bigger thing of people not wanting to go into what many would call the trades.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you go talk, I spend my time talking to manufacturing companies and customers. And the biggest problem right now is we had tons, especially in the U.S., lots of kind of mom and pop shops that got kind of big, but they would do a lot of this metal work, even for companies like SpaceX. This still happens today. And in a lot of cases, the kids have not ended up wanting to go take over the company. Other younger people haven't pursued these trades. And so right now we have this huge delays in getting spare parts in manufacturing writ large. And so it's not really replacing jobs as much as it's filling jobs that just are not kind of existing right now.
So what is the economic impact then for the consumer at the end of this whole chain? Selfishly, does this make anything cheaper for us?
It could make big things cheaper. One of the most exciting parts of what Machina is doing is that these robots can kind of do things really that humans can't. And because you don't have to, if you're a maker of cars, you don't have to put this huge investment. The dies that they use to stamp out body parts cost hundreds of millions of dollars when all is said and done. So if you want a customized car, you want something that's unique, these robots could do that cost effectively. And so there's this idea that we might have, much more choice and variety in some of these things that we buy.
How much do these puppies cost? Mm.
Well, the starter pack for the robots is
there's a starter pack.
It's about $2.5 million. You get two of these robots. They look like the ones that people might have seen on an automaker's line, a big arm that does stuff at the end. And then there's this big contraption that holds the sheet metal. And the real trick here is that metal behaves really strangely when you bend it and start working with it, and it does odd things. And that's why we have blacksmiths that have learned this stuff over centuries. And so these robots, with their software that comes in the package, actually know how to do these techniques, and they use AI software to get better over time. But you're kind of starting at about $2.5 million.
Well, I want to pick up on what you're mentioning, that it takes like this intense mastery of the craft. How surprised were you that a robot was able to successfully do this?
I was pretty shocked. So for the story, very quickly, I had my face digitized. It was scanned by a laser and turned into this 3D image that the computer could feed into the robots. And I expected something really crude, no offense to myself, to come out on the other side. I just didn't think the robot would, when you see these arms, they're huge. I didn't think it would be able to get all the contours of my face. And it did. It created this kind of 4-foot large bust of me, and it's very lifelike. It scares my children. I put it by them to keep watch on them when I'm not around.
Is it in the house somewhere?
It is. I got to keep this souvenir, and so
sheet over it. You're hiding it from the kids. No, go ahead.
So I was kind of shocked, because I was thinking I could see like a body panel for a car just sort of shaping metal into a curve, but this has my nose, my nostrils, my lips, everything. And so when you see this giant robot doing this, they have the small tools at the end. It was quite remarkable.
I love this line in your story, how you say that Machina's robots are still too slow to replace the mass production portion, manufacturing, if you will. But you say they are ideal for the earlier stages of the process, helping companies test their ideas before they commit money to final production. It allows companies, right, to kind of play around a little bit. And when we think about an innovation or disruption, this is a pretty cool thing.
Yeah, because if you're a car company and you want to make a new door for a new model, you have to pay for the dies to stamp out and the molds to produce all the doors along the way till you find the one that fits just right or that's shaped just right. And so that's millions of dollars every time you're making an iteration, where this robot can actually do these one-offs, these five-offs at the beginning of the process. And then it's only when you figure out exactly what you want that you then send it to the mass manufacturing process.
I think what's fun about this story, it takes me back to a job I had in high school and a little bit in college, and they made plastic parts like sprockets and belts. And it was all manufacturing. No, and they had molds, and like those molds were expensive. So like you think about how these things are made, and this really plays into it. Having said that, Ashley, you do have this great vantage point when it comes to what's going on in manufacturing. And even though we're such a service-led economy, a lot of stuff still gets made. What are kind of some of the big trends that you continue to see when it comes to manufacturing?
Well, yeah, we've got tools like 3D printing to go along with this. It's bringing this sort of automation and these machines and software into this puzzle. But the coolest thing, I would say, is that so much of this is happening in Los Angeles. There's probably, you know, 12 to 20 manufacturing startups that I could roll off, and they're all in LA. It's kind of this, it's a knock-on effect from the aerospace industry and the automotive industry, but to the extent that there is maybe a modernized leap forward in manufacturing, LA is probably the single point in the entire world where you see the most encouraging signs that this could happen.
Who'd have thunk?
I know, LA. Yeah. I would think by you more than LA.
Right. It's a little counterintuitive, but absolutely, when it comes to this stuff, it's happening in Los Angeles.
All right. This was a lot of fun. Love your stories, always, always. And you just kind of open up our mind to so many different things that are out there. So, Ashley, thank you so much. Take care. Ashley Vance there, guys. He's Bloomberg Businessweek features writer and author of Elon Musk, Tesla, SpaceX, and the Quest for a Fantastic Future, joining us via Zoom from Palo Alto, California.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses like yours effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekdays from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live to our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I wanna drive.
Keep driving crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, everybody, we've got just about 16 and a half minutes left in today's trading session, bouncing around here, but we are near our lows, as you heard from Charlie, when it comes to the equity trade, and we definitely have seen some movement in the yields off of those FOMC minutes, but we're up near just off our highs on that two-year at 4.69. We do want to talk about the markets. We've got Bryant Van Cronkhite with us. He's Senior Portfolio Manager, co-team leader for the Special Global Equity Team at Allspring Global Investments. They've got roughly $463 billion in assets under management. He is co-manager of the Allspring Special Mid-Cap Value Fund, which has returned on average about 9% annually over the past 5 years, putting it in the 87th percentile, according to Bloomberg data. That fund, by the way, Maddie, it's up about 4% year to date. Bryant joining us from Menomonee Falls, Wisconsin. Bryant, good to have you here on this. We're calling it a Fed Wednesday, an FOMC Wednesday, if you will. What do you think about most when you're trying to assess what's the smartest strategy in this particular financial market environment?
Hi, Carol, to be with you again.
Yeah.
I think there's two things to think about. I think we need to think about the macro, right? What's the Fed doing and how is that going to drive demand dynamics for individual companies? So with that in mind, I'm very focused on the paradigm shift that's taking place. The idea that the Fed can hop into the market and use lower rates and quantitative easing to support the economy, I think, is the paradigm of the last 30 years, not the paradigm of the next 10 years. And the focus now is on inflation, and their resolve is being questioned, but I don't think it should be questioned. I think they're going to continue to push higher on rates and push the economy into a slowing pattern. And with that said, from a
slowing pattern, does that mean recession or just slowing pattern?
I think recession is the most likely outcome. Now, the steepness of that recession, we have to debate, and that depends on the magnitude of the decisions from here. But the reality is, the symptom is inflation, the disease is employment, and the tools they have are very blunt. They don't have a lot of precision with their options here. And so we'll have to see how long they stick with the higher for longer, but my guess is it'll be longer than people are predicting today, which drives me to the idea that when picking stocks, we don't want to own companies that are reliant or dependent on a generous Federal Reserve. So identify companies that have unique secular demand drivers for their volume, have unique pricing power from a company's standpoint, and have great balance sheets. It's those balance sheets that allow companies the optionality to drive their own destiny, whether it's through acquisitions, buying back stock, organic investments. I think the combination of those three elements really can allow you to outperform both absolute and relative, independent of the Fed.
Right. I always think about WeWork when I think about the impact of a zero interest rate environment. So I want to get your take on tech here. I know that in your note, you say that you favor, you know, quality over low quality non-earners. What does that mean for tech? Because they love to grow and not necessarily have a lot of cash.
Yeah. The biggest beneficiaries from a generous Fed, as I've been saying for the last, you know, 10 plus years are the companies that need it the most, the ones who aren't standing on their own 2 feet yet, who they're not creating their own cash flow, the ones that have the most levered balance sheets because they benefit from lower cost of capital. And some of those companies show up in the tech space. There is value in tech, though. I think some of the software names that do produce stable cash flows are potentially being undervalued today as rates have moved higher, pushing multiples down in that regard. But for us, the focus is going to be on which companies within tech are producing cash flow today that can be used to cycle through value-creating investments like acquisitions or additional organic growth.
So let's get to names. As we mentioned, your fund has beaten most of its peers over the past 5 years, annually returning about 9% according to our Bloomberg data. One of the names that you like is Jacobs Solutions. The ticker is J. I'm looking at the stock. It's just down about 0.5% so far this year. It's a $15 billion market cap company that is involved in engineering and construction. What is it that jumps out for you on this one?
What we like about Jacobs is the transformation they've gone under for the last 5 years. They used to be a business that had end market exposure to oil and gas and other cyclical end markets, and they sold those assets, which we deemed non-core, and have reinvested through a series of acquisitions in businesses that put them at the center of the consulting and advisory services that are going to solve the most complex issues that our economy faces in the future, things like climate change and demographic shifts. And as they've done that shift with their asset base, they've now stabilized their cash flow production profile going forward. It's far less cyclical, far more stable. And along the way, that increases the amount of capital they can use for productive growth in the future. So today, the company has an underlevered balance sheet, is in the crosshairs of secular demand with the problems they're solving, and has the ability to play offense if the world does play defense. If the economy slows down, look for them to acquire competitors, look for them to buy back their stock. We think that combination allows them to compound value in the face of a challenging economy in the future.
I know that you also like Vulcan, and one of the reasons is because of its pricing power. To what extent is pricing power one of the key decision factors for you when you're figuring out where to put your money?
I think pricing power is perhaps the most significant indicator of a company having a competitive advantage. Right? If you can raise your prices when you want to and when you need to, that to me shows that your asset base is unique. And in the case of Vulcan, they play in the aggregate space. There's really only a few aggregate players in the U.S., and aggregates are the components that go into cement and concrete that ultimately build the bridges, build the buildings and the roads that we all rely on every day. And because of the uniqueness of this asset base, this industry has seen pricing go up almost every year for the last 50 years, the only exception being the great financial crisis, which indicates to me these are unique assets. And in last year, we're seeing double-digit pricing. And again, I think we'll see that in 2023. Now, from a volume standpoint, it can be a little cyclical, right? They are exposed to commercial real estate.
Right.
But they also have infrastructure spending, right? And think of all the bills we passed during the pandemic that are now just coming into funding stage. So I actually see demand more stable, pricing rising while their cost basket's falling.
All right, got to run. Brian, good to talk names with you and get your view. Brian Van Cronkite, he is portfolio manager at Allspring Global Investments, joining us on the phone from Menominee Falls, Wisconsin. You are listening and watching Bloomberg Business Week, and this is Bloomberg Radio.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live each weekday starting at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way, from design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/greenfestival.